Hi, this is Roz Bornstein, and this is take two of Becky Benaroya's oral history that we're gathering for the Jewish Women's Archive Weaving Women's Words Project. And the date is still July 17th, 2001, and we are still meeting at Becky's home in Seattle, Washington. And Becky, do I have your permission to continue interviewing and taping you?
Yes, of course.
Thank you very much. We were talking about relationships with marriage and compromise, and I wondered if you could comment on that a bit.
Well, I think that's what relationships are all about. There's too much of this power struggle, I think, in relationships, and it shouldn't be that way. There's a give and take, and it's something that I think that couples should learn to understand, that it can't be all one way, that if an issue is important, it should be discussed, and there's room for compromise. And I'll give an example. I love the ballet, and my husband doesn't like the ballet, or he didn't. And so this evening we're getting ready to go, and he said, "I really don't want to go. Why don't you call a friend?" So said, "Well, or, you know, if you want to go alone." I said, "I like to share it with someone. I don't want to just go by myself." So I invited a friend. But I invited a male friend. There was a reason behind this. I figured that'll get his attention. So next week was the football game. And I honestly don't enjoy football, but I've been going for years just because I felt that my husband would like me to go with him. So I thought, well, if he feels comfortable about not going to the ballet, I'm comfortable about not going to the football game. So I said, "Honey, why don't you invite a friend or your grandchildren or somebody?" He said, "Are you retaliating?" I said, "No." I said, "Just doing the same thing. I really don't like football. So just invite a friend." He didn't like that. So the next time the ballet, he came very quietly. And I said, "See, honey, the bottom line is that you're coming to please me, and I go to please you." So that was a good lesson.
It's a great story.
That's a compromise.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I find that a lot of people don't know that that's the way life is. We'd all like to have it our way. Wouldn't that be wonderful? So, you were asking me about my move to Cleveland, and I wasn't consulted at all because back then it was a male decision. And I would have liked to have been consulted, but since I wasn't, my job was to go along. And I think that it was easier then, where you didn't have that conflict. I knew that it was important for my husband, and so I went along. And then I found that it was a really growing experience for me to even just go and be on my own and learn that I could do things on my own and be independent. That was the best thing that happened to me.
In what way? What parts were the most important?
Reaching out, meeting people, and enjoying it, not just doing it because I knew I had to do it. And appreciating anybody that put themselves out because they already had their friends. They already had their groups. So if anybody reached out, I thought that was very special. So I learned also that when I moved back to Seattle and I heard when people would move and they'd be new to the city, that I wanted to greet them and welcome them because I knew what it meant to me. So this is what I mean about learning just from experience. So it's all part of growing up.
It's a lovely lesson.
Mm-hmm.
When you moved back to Seattle, how was that transition for you? What happened?
Well, I liked my independence so well that I didn't know how it would be when I came back. But as soon as we came back and we were with friends and family, it was wonderful. So it was fine. And again, it was shifting gears. Jack going into another business, and a challenge, but life isn't just that cut and dry. And I find that the more challenges you have, the more interesting your life is. You reach different plateaus.
What were the rewards and challenges during this time?
We were pretty secure when it was the way it was. You know, we knew that we had a very comfortable life. And then we didn't know what our future was, starting from scratch. And we were in the midst of building a new house, and it's always gets more involved than you anticipate. And there we were, wondering whether he would succeed in his new venture, and we have this house, so it's a little anxious times there. But we managed to do it. So that, too, makes you feel like it's a real sense of accomplishment. We've been through it together. Makes you stronger. And it's not everything that you see when you see people. You don't know what goes on to arrive where you are.
How did you support each other at this time?
Well, I just had confidence in my husband. I knew he could do it. And if we had to cut back, it was fine. If that's what we had to do. And he knew it. But he wouldn't want to do that. He just had to prove to himself that he could do it. So I knew he was going to accomplish that, because I think my parents already knew that about him, that he would be there and be conscientious and support us, and he did.
Sounds like you worked together as a good team, I would say.
Well, you know, back then, I would say I like the way the young couples are today. I was in charge of the household and raising the children, and his big job was his office and making a living. And I felt that the children missed not growing up with the father. He'd be there on the weekends, but not really everyday exchanges. And a few times I'd tell him about the cute things that the children did, and he missed it. But I guess it had to be like that, his generation. He's first generation, too.
And where was he born?
He was born the day they arrived in Montgomery, Alabama. He was conceived in Beirut.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And the father and mother came over with four other children and the pregnant wife, who was ready to deliver. They were delayed in Marseille because his mother had an eye infection. So they didn't plan it that closely. They planned on getting here a few months before the delivery date. So they barely made it. And they moved in with his mother's brother's family. So they already had three children. They just had a new baby, like 2 weeks old. Then this family of six comes in.
Isn't that something?
And I remember asking his aunt, "How did you ever do it?" She said, "We never questioned it. We just did it. We never questioned it." But this cousin, this one that was 2 weeks older, there's another cousin that's a matter of days or weeks. Well, Jack's birthday, then we were all back there for the 80th birthday party for the two Jeanettes and Jack, his two cousins from Montgomery. They're the same age. So all these babies that are born and this family that comes in from Europe, no diaper service, no maid service.
A lot of bottles to wash.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think Rosie was in diapers when hit Jack's sister. She wasn't quite two.
Actually, was there bottle feeding at that time? I'm assuming that.
I don't know if they breastfed or if they bottle fed. I don't know.
And with your generation, what was that?
Both. My mother thought breastfeeding was old-fashioned. That was fine with me.
So the trend was towards bottle feeding.
Yes, and then it goes back to nature.
Right.
Yeah. But at that time, my mother thought it was old-fashioned. One of my friends was breastfeeding. She would come over because she was with her mother. It was during the war, just like I was with my mother. We were a block apart, and she'd come over with her baby. And she was nursing. And I think my mother liked my giving the baby the bottle. She thought that was very modern.
It's also easy for other people to feed the baby.
Like my mother.
That's great.
She thought it was her baby.
it sounds like you became active in different volunteer and philanthropy.
Oh, I remember I got involved with Hadassah when I first came back.
Okay. I'd love to hear
how did I meet this friend? Oh, through Mahjong. I think we played Mahjong in those days.
Could you describe, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but could you describe that? Because that's really...
Mahjong?
Yeah.
Well, it takes four players, and you play with tiles. And you have to remember the tiles. You call the tile before you draw a tile. You call the tile when you put it down. You could put it in your rack. I forget the game because I haven't played in a while. And you try to make up hands. There's a card. Every year they come out with different hands, different combination of tiles. And the first one that comes with a hand says Mahjong. And they play for money. You decide whether small stakes or bigger stakes. So it's a four-handed game. We used to play once or twice a week.
Is this with other women?
Other women.
Okay.
It's a game that men play too. And it's a very big gambling game in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. Big money there. They don't change the rules. And the difference there is they flash the card and turn it over. So you have to remember. See, if you're trying to get a hand and that tile has been discarded, then you know that hand isn't going to be made. Then now you have to change your hand for remaining tiles, hopefully that you can make that hand with other tiles that you're going to draw. So in Hong Kong, I saw them play, where they turn the tile over and you don't know, you forget. It's a very, very intense game. So we used to play that, and that's how I met different girls in the neighborhood, and they started this Hadassah group, and it was social.
Were these Sephardic and Ashkenazi women?
Yes.
I see.
Yes. Now, when I lived in Cleveland, there weren't any Sephardic, so they were all Ashkenazi friends. That was my introduction to the outside world. In fact, when I was selling raffle tickets to the cleaners, my friend told me to sell to your cleaners. She said, "What are you doing selling B'nai B'rith tickets? You're not Jewish." I said, "Yes, I am. I'm Sephardic." She said, "Say something in Yiddish." I said, "I don't speak Yiddish. I'm Sephardic." "What's Sephardic?" And I found out there was only one other couple and us that were Sephardic in Cleveland. The other couple was from South America. So they didn't know about Sephardics in Cleveland. There wasn't a population. So the friends were Ashkenazim, and they were introduced to Sephardic food. They liked my burekas better than their, what did they call them? Their potato...
Oh, knishes?
Knishes, yeah. We like your burekas better than our potato knishes. And I'll admit they are better. The other thing, customs. My friend's relative passed away. This friend, Bess Agin, she told me that her relative passed away. I didn't know who it was, but it was her relative. So I said, "Oh." I said, "Where can I send flowers?" And she said, "Are you sure you're Jewish?" I said, "Why? Only Goyim send flowers." I said, "What do you do?" So you notice that it's different customs in different areas.
Okay,
I said, "Well, I said in Seattle they send flowers. Here that you bring food when you go call on the family." So you learn different customs. It's not only one way, the only way that I knew. And they questioned our Judaism because our reading was different than their reading.
How so? What were the differences when you were growing up? It'd be great to hear. Was there Ladino in the...
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Ladino.
Was it...
And Hebrew.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So the melodies were different as
yes,
well?
Okay. Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. You get familiar, you like the familiar melodies, which you grow up with.
What was the women's role in public synagogue life when you were growing up and in the early years?
Women didn't speak up. The men did.
Mm-hmm. And
I found it very interesting when one lady did get up, when they talked about merging the two congregations, Ezra Beseret and the Bikur Hulam, and their children were already marrying both, you know, Rodislis and Tikir Delis. They were both marrying, and so what's the big deal? Well, this woman said no, that she wanted to keep it separate, even though she had two or three daughter-in-laws that were, her sons were Rodislis and her daughter-in-law were from Turkey.
That's something.
Uh-huh. So it was interesting. She, for a woman to stand up and not even be in agreement, she was opposing. It was most unusual. Yeah, you didn't do it in those days. Very few women that spoke up. There was one other lady, Anna Adado. And her son, I think, was writing for the archives. Albert Adado? Is it a professorship? Is he professor? No, he was in the Army, captain. Mm-hmm. Captain Albert Adado. And her children were all educated. They all went to college. And she was her own person, very colorful. But they were rare, very rare.
So the women played kind of behind the scene roles?
But or? I think behind the scene, but they got everything they wanted. They manipulated, but they acted like the man was the head of the household. But they weren't suppressed.
When did that change over time, or how have you seen that evolve?
How did that evolve? Well, I remember when we were first married and we saw how other couples related and how women would talk about how they handle things with their husbands. Example, her husband would ask, "Is that a new dress?" "Oh, no. You just don't remember it. I've had it a long time." Then, behind his back, he would kill me if he knew I bought it. "Well, where did she get the money?" So she must have had her own little way of getting extra money. And I remember my husband saying, "Now, isn't that stupid? That man is paying for it. Why shouldn't he get credit for it? Why does it have to be like this? That man's paying for it anyway." So you pat him on the back. "Thanks, honey." So that was how we related. And we never felt that we had to do things like this.
Sounds like you had open communication.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Oh, it's the best way. I like to know where I stand. I think everyone does.
So, at what point in time, as you were raising your children, did you become involved in the arts in Pilchuck School? Maybe
trying to think how long ago. We were early collectors when they first started.
Maybe I should have you describe Pilchuck School for those outside of the Northwest.
Well, it's a school that's internationally known. People come from all over the world. It's built on a campus that was belonged to John Hauberg, who had this acreage. It's a tree farm. And he wanted to have kind of a little museum, kind of something out there. And he approached several artists that weren't interested. Then he found Dale Chihuly and another friend. And Dale Chihuly, who was very famous worldwide, really got the glass movement going. And he was like a hippie in those days, maybe like 30 years ago. So he went up there with a couple of buddies and they built tents because there wasn't any housing and built a little furnace where they can do glass, blow their glass. And it became very famous. People wanted to come. And it was really during the hippie days anyway, where people lived in communes and tents and arty, very creative. And that's how Pilchuck started. Now they have wonderful buildings and very modern facilities. And they have open house once a year to the public. It's open to the public. And they have, the campus is open year-round, but during the summer it's like full steam ahead. And they have students come from all over, scholarships where people pay. And the office is in the city, downtown. So we were asked to come to an auction that was at the Henry Gallery, the first one we went to. I believe it was their second auction, but it was our first.
Do you remember what year this was? I'm sorry to
interrupt. I would say about 25 years ago. I don't know exactly what year. I would say 25 years ago. So that gets you back to about 76. we went to this auction, and we went because a friend of ours invited us. I remember getting the invitation, you know, in the mail, and I threw it out. Then I get another invitation signed now. Hope you can make it. And I said, well, you know, you support your friends. Let's go. So that's how we happened to go. And everything we saw, we wanted to bid on. And we ended up with two pieces. And it's kind of fun to have what was then a big piece, Dale Chihuly's, this big. And so we have his work that's as he progressed. So it's a nice retrospective. That was the beginning. Then they asked us, they saw the interest that we had. We were asked to join the board. I was, and then Jack was asked to join the board. And you just meet all these people that come from all over. Then we joined the American Crafts Museum in New York. And these people are interested in all kinds of work. Fiber, ceramics, glass, jewelry, any kind of wood carving. So they go on these wonderful trips that are very well planned, and you meet these people. And if you go to a few of them, you're having a reunion again. So it's been really fun and a growing experience, even though you don't collect certain things. But you're going to these galleries because you have to go to everybody's interest. You're learning something from it all the time.
In what way has it been a growing experience?
Just meeting people from different walks of life. We met this lady that has her doctorate in art. We've become very good friends. At the time, we were in Paris when we met her. And we were looking at things that we were interested in, and she would tell us, this is not a good piece by this artist, or she would guide us.
Isn't that something?
So we have visited back and forth, and she's very Jewish. Her son is a very famous rabbi, Mark. She's remarried. I'm trying to think of her first name. I can't think of it now. But you probably have heard of the name. When this black man was, what was his name? Jesse Jackson. It was divulged that he has a child out of wedlock. It was publicized. He went to see this rabbi. For counseling, yeah. Mark, I can't think of his name.
Is he a Sephardic rabbi?
No, they're not Sephardic.
Okay.
No, you're thinking Mark
Angel.
Yeah, he has that wonderful congregation.
So it sounds like your interest in design and your artistic abilities spilled over into this. Is what I'm guessing, is that...
You know what's good? If you both like the same things, then it's... When you're shopping or traveling, they have this common interest. You want to do, you know, go to antique shops or whatever. We both enjoy doing it. We know a couple that were both very strong-willed, and they ended up going in different directions. They didn't want their marriage to break up, so they got counseling. And in the course of counseling, he asked what their common interests were. It's glass collecting.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So they concentrated on that. They were buying glass with a vengeance. They have a collection that doesn't quit. Their opening show at the American Crafts Museum was their collection. And it's traveled, and they donated a lot of their work to a museum, but they're still collecting. They're passionate about it. So they found a common interest. So I always think that if a couple has something like this, it's good. So we've enjoyed it. And we've come to, thank you, we've come to conclusion that we both have to like. Can you imagine, I love this, I hate it, and you buy it. And it's a sore spot every time you look at it. We both have to love it. And at this point, we've bought so many things. We have to love it before we buy it now. And if one of us doesn't like it, it's fine with me if he takes it to the office. I don't have to look at it. So that's our compromise. So it's been fun, and we've gone on wonderful trips. And it's different when you go on in a group trip. It's a well-planned trip. You're meeting families, because you're seeing their collections, and And you see what other people collect and how they display it. It's a learning experience. And we have our house open for groups that come through.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. I had a group Saturday, as a matter of fact.
That's really wonderful.
Oh, it's fun to share.
Yeah. Gosh, so have you volunteered in other ways for Kolchak School, or have you...
No, I've just been on the board, and I've done fundraisers for them. And I think that we're a very important part of the Kolchak Glass movement, because when people come to see the collection, if they're drawn to a particular artist's work, they want to know who handles their work, and eventually they buy. So it encourages, the artists know that we have been very instrumental in their success, and the galleries. So it's just that kind of a good experience. Mm-hmm. In the desert, I like to work with children at the school, volunteer with their reading. They are so cute. Most of them come from families that don't speak English. There are a lot of Mexican children. And they only speak Mexican Spanish at home. So they don't comprehend what they're reading. If they're reading, they don't know what they're reading. And it's like when Jack told the stewardess on the airline when she was announcing we were landing in Israel, half of it was in Hebrew and then in English. So he tells the stewardess, you know, I can read Hebrew, but I don't understand what I'm saying. And she says, how could that be? You can read it, you don't understand. Well, he was taught Hebrew without understanding what he was reading. Well, it's the same thing with these children. I can understand that. They can read it, but they don't know what they're reading. So working with them has been wonderful.
Where do you do this?
At school, at an elementary school.
And when you mentioned...
In Cathedral City in Palm Springs.
I see. Okay, you mentioned the desert, and I wasn't sure which...
Oh, Palm Springs.
That is marvelous. So when did you start working with these children?
Oh, about 10 years ago,
and
when I first became a homeowner.
What motivated you to work with them?
Well, a friend of mine asked if I'd like to do it. I said, sounds like fun. So I've gotten other people involved. Some have stayed with it, others haven't. But I don't think they like volunteers that don't show up. They're counting on you. So.
Do you have any stories of children in particular that...
Oh, a couple of them stand out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One is, I'm sure, will be a fabulous artist.
Really?
After he'd read a story, he said, do you want me to draw the picture? And however he perceived the story, he would just free draw. Well, the teacher gave me a couple of his pictures and had them framed for my reward. And he saw them framed and he didn't want to part with them because they looked so nice. He signed it and everything, said he wanted them back, and the teacher said, you can make some other ones. There was one child, I was reading the story. Sometimes I read so they'll know the expression of reading, and then they could read back to me. This word, I think it was balcony, and I said, you know what a balcony is? And I could see where they wouldn't know, because houses there are all one floor. How would they know what a balcony is? And the other thing is they don't have that much exposure to other things to relate. So I said, you know a veranda? No. Do you know what a porch is? I was going to say, if you know what a porch is, then it's on a second level. And this kid said, is it a car? You think of a Porsche. Well, we had a good laugh. They're very good with the computer. I told him that I don't know how to do the computer. He said, well, you help me with my reading, so when we go to the computer, I'll help you.
Is that right?
And he'll praise me. Very good.
And what ages?
Sweet.
What ages?
They're first to third grade.
That's terrific.
Yeah, 6, 7, 8 years old.
And how often do you do this?
A couple of times a week.
And what are the rewards and challenges for you?
The rewards? Just seeing them progress. And then when it becomes a challenge, I have to talk to the teacher. The problem there, they come tired. They're yawning. They're scratching their eyes. They don't get to bed on time. Mm-hmm. So I'd ask them a little bit about their personal life. It's pretty sad. Half the time they don't have a father around. This one child, I didn't have her regularly. Her mentor wasn't there, so the teacher asked if I would take her. So you have to read words that you're learning. Like if you're reading a story and you come across words that you don't know. So you write it on a card and make a sentence out of it. So if you can read that word 3 times in a row, you get a little X and you put it in a jar and then you get a prize after so many words. So she had this word, my brother is mean to me. That was her sentence. My brother, mean was the word. So I said, very good. She read the word. So she goes on, tell me how mean he is. So I said, well, maybe your dad should intervene. Does he know what's going on? Oh, his dad is in prison. Oh. Are there other children in the family? Well, what about that dad? Anyway, there aren't any dads and 3 different children. Her dad is remarried, lives in Mexico, and he has his own children. Oh, you hear things like this and you wonder, you talk to the teacher and how can this child be helped? Not that she's slow, she's just carrying the whole world on her shoulders. Just not fair.
Right.
So you get a lot of those. And then you get some real bright ones and keeps you going. But it really, you don't know what the other, how the other half live. You haven't a clue.
It's true unless you live directly sometimes. It's hard to know, isn't it?
It is.
I guess what I'm really struck with as you're talking is how diverse your interests and passions are, from art to working with children and cooking. It's really remarkable to me, I have to tell you. Another area that I've noticed is bridge. Is that something that you do regularly?
What's that?
Play bridge? Do you play?
Oh, that's, yeah, I love it. Uh-huh. I play twice a week.
Is that right? So has it replaced Mahjong, or is it?
I don't play Mahjong. Okay. No, if I had time for one, it would be bridge.
Is that right?
Most of my friends still play both games, but I don't devote that much time.
Twice
a week is good.
How did you start playing bridge?
I'm trying to remember. Somebody must have suggested taking bridge lessons at the Y, because I remember going to the Y. And then we were playing, but we weren't playing well. And somebody telling me you should play with better players, that's the only way you learn. Then we took more lessons. And then, when I was playing tennis, the girls were talking about let's play bridge afterwards. So let's take lessons. So our bridge game became bridge and tennis. And that was fun. And
where do you play bridge, typically?
At home. Well, I like to have it at home. Most of the girls are having it out, where you don't have to cook lunch.
And where? I bet.
Well, yesterday we played at the yacht club.
I see.
And they said, you know, it's centrally located for people that live on the east side and the north and here, which it is. But I'm having a game here on Friday, and next Friday different girls. Yeah. But I will prepare lunch.
Is it all Jewish women, or are there?
Yes,
the mix?
They are.
I see.
I have played duplicate at the tennis club, where you have your partner, and then you're playing with women that aren't, well, men and women that aren't Jewish. But I don't like playing duplicate as much as social bridge. Mm-hmm. I like the game, but I also like to be with my friends. It's more of that than the game itself. And in the desert, I play a lot more bridge. There's more games there than here.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So how often would you play?
I played Saturday, Monday, Tuesday, 3 or 4 times.
Mm-hmm.
That's La La Land. It's a lot of fun and games.
It sounds great. Now, how often are you there, though? What's your...
Well, we're there about 5.5 months.
I see.
It started out where it was going to be a few weeks at a time, and it just progressed. And I would say that's as primary home as this is. I used to say this is my primary home. But that's I'm there just about as much as we are here.
Sounds wonderful. And do you have a community down there that
you... Yes, we belong to a country club. And we live in a gated area, Morningside. We belong to that club, too. And it's an independent, freestanding house, but it is, they call them condominiums, mm-hmm. because they take care of the common areas, the outside of your house and the roof. Mm-hmm. The rest is your own private. So it's nice because you have the security, and if you're not there and the service person has to come, they'll let them in. It's very nice. It's like here because I have the valet here that could come up and get something if I needed it. But it's the best of both worlds. We're here for the wonderful summer and there for the winter. And I can step out with the house and here you're in a high rise. So it's kind of nice having the two.
Sure.
We're at the age now where I think we can do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Jack had a harder time liking it.
Is that right? How mm-hmm. so? What was his...
Well, he didn't ever learn to play. When he was playing tennis, he liked it better, but he's not able to now. So, he's not... He doesn't... Men, I think, are more like that. I don't think he's unusual. Making plans, getting together with buddies. They call him. There's a little group now that he belongs to. They go to lunch. It's wonderful.
That's great.
So, he doesn't socialize as much as I do. And he's still involved in business and his investments, so he keeps happy that way.
Wonderful at 80, isn't that great?
Yes, it is. It now, is. But, you know, we have a lot of friends that are older. You should see them dancing. They stay as long as the band's playing. And I see younger people leaving at 10 o'clock. Yeah, they all take dancing lessons, these friends that are older, and they have a ball. But Jack has Parkinson's now, so he isn't as mobile. But he's doing fine, considering.
How has his health impacted you or him, you know, your
the
marriage?
What?
His health, has it been, how has that been for you?
Well, it was pretty devastating when I heard, but I couldn't let on because he was having a tough time. So, I said there are a lot of things that are worse, and there are. I convinced myself. I said, you're still functioning. It's not life-threatening. It does debilitate you, but it's not life-threatening. And there's wonderful medication now that's keeping it under control. And then I had to add, you're lucky you have me. And he laughed. So I have to remind him periodically when he gets down that there's a lot worse. And he agrees. So, you know, we're really pretty lucky to have each other all these years. February will be 60 years for our anniversary.
Congratulations. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So we're blessed. You know, everything now is a bonus.
You mentioned tennis, which is kind of, I'm just taking a step back, and I want to pick up on that before I let it go completely. You mentioned bridge and tennis, and that's one area that he hasn't been able to play as much, but...
He was never a card player.
I see, so he would play tennis?
Tennis.
With you, or...
Sundays we would go, we'd play tennis and then go to brunch with another couple. That was nice.
Mm-hmm. And in Seattle?
That was the only time we played together.
I see. In Seattle or in...
Both. We have tennis courts right out here. And then the two clubs had tennis courts.
Do you still play? Or?
Not as much. My friends have all given it up. And in the desert, the pro will call me and put a game together. And if I call her and she can't get a game, she'll play with me. So I still try to play, but it's not the same when you're not playing with your friends. The social aspects, like my bridge, I like to play with my friends. So things change as you start losing friends. I just had a terrible phone call the other day. Very dear friend that I knew, a new friend. And when I say friend, you know, you can use that term very loosely, but this was a friend. I met her down in Palm Springs. She lived at Morningside where we live. Perfect health. And she died yesterday. Funeral's tomorrow. A disease that they don't even know what it is. It affected her brain. But when I left her, she was in perfect health. She called me when she was home and I was here. Talked to the machine. I got her message. Just thinking about you and hoping you're all fine. And she said, I want you to know we love you. That was the last I heard from her. When she was putting things away, she had sort of a memory lapse and she didn't know where things were, why she put them where she did. But it was happening more frequently and her husband took her in, and a disease that was progressive, and she died in less than 2 months. Very sad.
Sounds very tragic.
So that's the sad thing about getting older, losing good friends. And it's happening lately.
What lessons have you learned from those kinds of illnesses, and what perspective?
You know, I always think of my grandfather, that life has different things at different times. You reach different plateaus, and there are always things to look forward to. And I'm sure there are.
And of those lessons, what have you shared with your children?
Well, I remember my daughter asking me on my 60th birthday, how do you feel? Like, you know, senior citizen. I said, I don't know, it's just a number. I said, I wouldn't have all this if I weren't this old. Got my children, grandchildren, they're all blessings. So I try to tell them, you know, there's good things to look forward to. I don't know how much they get out of it. I know when my mother used to tell us, it went in one ear and out the other, and you digest it when you're experiencing it.
Isn't that something? Mm-hmm. So at the time it seems...
But it's planted. It's a seed. It's planted.
So let's see, you have 3 children,
mm-hmm.
and how many grandchildren do you have?
4.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe your experience of being a grandmother?
Well, I remember my mother telling me when she found out that I was going to be a grandmother, she's, you think you know what you have in store. You don't have a clue. You just wait. And that's the way it is. Yeah.
And how has it been?
They're wonderful. They're all different. Uh-huh. They're all different. I was closer to my daughter's children than my daughter's-in-law because she had her mother that was home all the time. That's the other thing. Her mother wasn't in good health. So she could always count on her mother to babysit. And she never asked me. One time she asked me. Her babysitter let her down. And my granddaughter was like 3, and she says, Grandma, this is the first time you babysat me. And I knew it. But she never asked me, and so I felt like, you miss out on something. But it's, you don't have that bonding at the beginning, but you make up for it. Now that they're adults and we keep in touch, they are wonderful. They're very special. But I had a different feeling with my daughter's children.
So that early bonding at the beginning is...
Well, they were like my children. I knew how my mother felt when she had that baby. Yeah, they're just like your own children. In fact, you mix them up. Their names, I call it Donna, I mean Renee, I mean, you know. Yeah, it's special.
How do you think parenting has changed over time, over the generations?
I think that parents want to be buddies with their children rather than letting the children know that there's someone that makes the decisions for them when they're little. And I think it's a big mistake because the children start telling the parents. And then you're out of control. And children need to be led. Yeah. So I think that's the difference. I think that what happens is you get too much of this domineering parenting, and then you're too lax the other way. There'll be a happy medium. I know we were very strict, because my parents were very strict. And maybe I was too strict.
With so, rules or with...
all of them. All of them. They had the same kind of... There were rules and regulations, and they had to abide by it. I had a nephew that was living with me for a while, and he didn't have rules. His mother had remarried, and anyway, I told him he could live with us. And he was coming and going as he pleased. And I said, you can't do that. You can't do that. My children are going to resent it, that you have all this leeway and they don't. If you're living here, these are the rules. You have to let me know if you're going to come home for dinner. You can't just pop in and out, or I'm waiting. I said, I have to know. My children have to tell me where they are, when they're, if they're coming home for dinner. Not just let it ride. He didn't have to. His mother was working before she married, and he came and went. So he had a hard time going by these rules. But I knew that he had to abide by it. Or my children would say, I'm showing favoritism. They didn't want rules. Yeah, we were pretty strict. Maybe too strict. But you know, you do how you've been brought up, and you think that's the only way that there is to do it. You try to modify it a little bit someplace or another. I know where I modified it. My mother would say, lay the rules down, and then change your mind later. You know, she'd say, no, you can't do it, and then, oh, all right, go after, you know, wear her out with arguing. All right, go. So we always knew we could get our way. So I said, I'm not going to budge. If I lay the rule down, this is it. I would tell them, fair warning, this is it. And I wouldn't budge because I had my mother wrapped around my finger, even though she was strict. My dad, you couldn't do that. His word was law. So you try to compensate for one and the other. So maybe I was too much. And I think with my children, maybe they feel that they didn't like certain things. They're going to do it their way. Well, I know my daughter-in-law and my son are doing a beautiful job with their children. I've got the best daughter-in-law anybody could want. She is wonderful. She's a wonderful girl. So I feel very blessed.
Is there, you know, that they have also made huge philanthropic endeavors in the city and nationally, and I'm wondering how that has been passed down in your family through the generations, that your generosity and your...
I think that it's rubbed off.
Compassion for...
Yeah, I think it's rubbed off.
How do you think that's come about? Do you have any sense of that?
Maybe because they know how we feel about it. I think being first generation, you have a different feeling about achieving. And I think that when you inherit, it's a different kind of a feeling, but when you've earned it and you feel very grateful that you're here in this country and you have these opportunities, you want to give something back to your community. We've always felt this way. The children have heard us talk about it. And I think they feel that this is what it's all about. Why not share? They're fortunate to be in the position to do this. And our grandson is diabetic. And everybody's very fond of this Michael. He's a special young man. And so, you know, they want to help out with this too. They're very generous. This research center, we're hoping, will do miracles. They're very excited about what's happening with the diabetes. They feel there's a breakthrough. So, I'm sure there will be something in his lifetime. So the whole family's involved with this. It's a special little guy. He's doing really well. He's 20 and has his diabetes under control. Devastating when we heard about it. He was 5 and a half.
What were the circumstances? Did you?
He was out of school thinking he had the flu or a cold or something. They do think that a virus could cause this juvenile diabetes. And Sherry noticed that he was always thirsty and urinating frequently. So she told Larry, oh, come on, she's got a cold. But she had a premonition, and when he was feeling better, she had an appointment with the doctor at 2 o'clock that day, but Michael was feeling better. She sent him off to school. She took in a specimen that morning so that when she went in for the appointment, it would be analyzed and they'd be ready. They called her from school. He was sort of sleepy, They had him laying down on the floor, wet up to his neck. She grabbed him. She knew already. Ran to the doctors and then to Children's Orthopedic. And that was, yeah, it was a terrible day. I remember having a luncheon here for Federation the day I heard that he was in the hospital. It was all I could do for the ladies to get out of here so I could go over there and find out what's going on. It was awful. But my niece's mother-in-law was here. We both cried together. Her son, Harvey Pohl. Do you know who he is? He died of diabetes, too. Diabetes complications. So, you get through that. But anyway, that's why diabetes is our favorite charity and the research.
So it's an example of how your family took a situation like that of an illness and really...
do something about it.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
How does that feel to know that your family has really done that, responded that way?
Special.
In what way do you think?
It was selfish. Let's start out with that. But we just felt that we knew we had good people here doing research. And Jack, being a businessman, figured that if you give them proper facilities, you get other good people that want to work here. It's a business kind of mentality and also doing something.
So it sounds like your family drew on so many strengths, you know, business knowledge and compassion for people.
Mm-hmm.
And
I guess all those things.
All of those things, mm-hmm, pulled together for you, didn't, mm-hmm, it? And benefit so many people now.
But I have found that Jack has always analyzed things in a very business-like manner. Take the symphony hall. We had a very good conductor, and he didn't have a home. And we knew he was being offered other jobs elsewhere in the country. How do you keep good health? So that's why he felt we have to do something.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. So he had lunch with Jerry and said, what does it take? How much do you need? Named a figure. And he said, okay, I'll go for it. And then the rest is history. But it's always with a business-like approach.
And it sounds like a lot of passion for
yes,
uh-huh, music.
That's our city. We love our city.
Mm-hmm. And it's been so greatly appreciated by the city, what you've done.
Yes, it is wonderful. It's very gratifying. And now that we're in the desert, he said, you know, we support Seattle. How can we do both? I said, we live here. And you help. You support here, too.
So it sounds like there's a partnership in this work as well.
No question.
How so? How's your partnership in this philanthropy work?
Oh, just whenever he said, what do you think? I always say, go for it. Well, he knows if he can do it financially. If he thinks he can do it, go for it. We're not going to live any differently. And that's what people don't understand. I remember when Federation started with the ladies' division. I think it was $50 to go to the luncheon. And I think I was soliciting at that time, too. And the pitch was, so you'll do without a dress, or you'll do without going out for dinner. Give till it hurts. I don't think you have to give till it hurts. You're not going to live any differently. You think that if they gave $50, they're still not going to buy a dress that they wanted? You can give $50, you can buy the dress, too. So, in those days, you know, you could get clothes. And today, it's the same thing. You're not going to do without. I don't think people are depriving themselves. It's just sharing. So, whenever he'd say, what do you think? I would say, go for it. We don't live any differently. I don't feel that I want to live on a different level. I do feel that if there's something you want to put off, for whatever reason, I say, don't put it off, not at our age. So, this is what I say, live today.
So you have a different perspective in your older years that...
Oh, sure, yeah. Sure. But I also feel when people leave things in their will, they don't get the feeling of giving and seeing the end result, the product. You know, you could say, I'll leave this for, in my will, and to organizations, which we will still do, but in the meantime, we want to see the product while we're alive. So, I think it's, a lot of people should do that instead of waiting till they're gone. Can't take it with you. You're not going to spend it all. People at our age, they're already established. Young couples, they have a lot of things ahead of them. Children's education, and very important.
In a discussion that we had earlier where you were talking about fundraising, you had some important messages that you expressed, and I would love to get some of those on tape.
I don't recall.
Well, you had recently had dinner out with another couple.
And oh, yes.
Talking about fundraising.
Fundraising, yeah. How passionate she felt about giving. Mm-hmm. After achieving a certain level, they felt that they had to give something tzedakah. That's how she expressed it. And so she and her husband discussed it a little further. And she convinced him that they should give more. But, you know, they're a fairly young couple, too, and fairly new at being successful. So, you know, it's an education. Where do you want to give it? Where is your priority? So it takes a little doing, knowing where you want to give. I remember when they approached Bill Gates when he first became famous. He was in his 30s. And he said he was so busy building up his business, it never occurred to him what his interests were. He was really busy building up Microsoft. So I could understand that he just didn't think about where his priorities were as far as giving, but he certainly has done more than his share. And people were criticizing, and I didn't know that was called for, because he was helping the economy just by hiring people. Yeah, it was a big industry right there. And now, of course, he and his wife, I'm sure that they're a team when it comes to giving. So it comes a time in your life where you're not ready to even think about it. And then you think that you're in a position. You're living in a city that's a beautiful city, and you want to give something back.
At what point in the life of your marriage did that happen for you and Jack?
You know, when I told you the time when we came back from Cleveland, we were doing our house and didn't know if we could even keep the house financially. So I don't know how long. Things like this weren't really discussed as to where we were financially. I know that we were able to keep the house and furnish it, and I didn't know how hard it was for him to do this. So I'm trying to think when he really felt comfortable. In his business, he borrowed so much money. He always said he was the best bank's customer. That's only because he borrowed so much money. So he never felt it was his money, even though he had the buildings, but not cash flow. I think when it really happened was when he sold the properties, that he felt now he could do it and be comfortable. He never felt he could. Well, when he gave to Federation, I know he didn't feel he could borrow to pay Federation. He didn't feel right about that. So he borrowed for his business, but not for donations. So he felt a little restricted. But I think after he was able to feel that he had control of the money, then he wanted to share. So I would say he's always given to Federation, but in larger amounts since he sold the properties.
And the two of you have really worked as a team when that's...
Well, we always felt, yeah. If he's a little reluctant, I push him.
Is
yeah,
that right?
Go for it. Mm-hmm. And there's no squabble over that. It's fine. It's just like a sounding board. He probably was going to do it anyway. But just,
well,
just reconfirm.
But that sounding board, it sounds like it gives him a tremendous amount of support or encouragement, or what do you think?
Well, I think it's important, don't you?
Absolutely.
To feel that you're doing the right thing?
Yes.
Yeah, to have someone that whose ideas you want to hear. I think it's good to have that reinforcement.
Very important. Becky, in talking with you about different family memories and holiday experiences, you mentioned a wonderful memory about Sukkot. And I wondered if you would share that experience with us as a child.
Well, I had some wonderful experiences with my grandfather. He was always there as an extra little buddy. And for Sukkot, he had built this trellis years before with this grapevine growing over it, and he trained it to go over this area that he had built behind the garage. He put benches so he could sit out there. And this trellis that was with the grapevine. And so for Sukkot, I seem to remember that every year was like a beautiful fall day. It was sunny. And we'd hang these cookies that my mother made, bizcochos, and the fruits, the grapes particularly, and the pears and apples. It was so much fun. He tied the little string on the things that were going to be hung, and he'd pick me up so I could tie it up on top. And so we felt like we did it together. They were wonderful memories. I've never had a sukkah since. It was my grandfather that did all this. But I was glad I had the exposure where I knew what the celebration was about. And it was always fun.
Do you remember, were there any special foods or any other customs besides
No, that? I just remember the decorating. That was so much fun. I think we just had a regular dinner.
Mm-hmm.
We'd eat out there. Table was set up. But I don't remember the food.
Were there any blessings that were
said? Oh, sure. Uh-huh. Always, before you ate anything, there was a blessing.
Is that right?
Always. Uh-huh. Especially if it was first of the season, there was an extra blessing. Shehiyanu. Before you. In those days, you didn't have, it was seasonal fruits. You didn't have them shipped in from other areas. So
right.
If you're eating watermelon for the first time that season or a cherry, it was always at Shehiyanu.
So there were always the blessings.
Always a blessing.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny how that leads into our other topic that we wanted to talk about, and that is an uncle of Jack's.
It's 100 years old.
100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And could you describe your relationship with him and the lessons you've learned from him?
Well, I often wondered what made him so special, because we've gone to Montgomery 2-3 times a year. That's where Jack has all his relatives on his mother's side. And he lost his wife. And after a few years living alone, he decided he should go to a assisted living. He didn't like that because that was regimented. He had to get up for breakfast, and he didn't want to get up when they wanted him to get up. So he checked out and moved into a independent living. And he's very happy there. And he likes to cook, little Sephardic things that he enjoys. And this last visit, when we were there in Montgomery, there were a few little parties because of the 80th birthday parties. And I was watching him. He's very sharp of mind. He's got a wonderful memory. He's blessed. It isn't just 100 years old. He's very interested and very involved. And he's a historian, that we should be asking him questions about the family. You always think of questions after they're gone. So I was thinking, what made him tick? And I realized I never heard him complain. After he was widowed, he didn't complain. He just knew that he had to change things and have help in the house, and he just adjusted to it. And blessed with the years that he had with his wife. And his nephews and nieces adore him, and they always go pick him up. He likes to go to Friday night services. And they'll pick him up and take him to the doctor or whatever needs that he has. And he's just very appreciative, and I found that he's not expecting anything. Whatever happens, he's appreciative. And I learned that if you're not expecting, you can't be disappointed. just take what you have. And he knows that he has these wonderful nieces and nephews that love him. And so I thought we could all learn how to get old. Don't complain. Don't ask people to do things for you. Try to be as independent as you can. And I think people will love you for it. I think that was, he's a good role model.
Well, it's been wonderful to hear your stories and to gather your history today.
And may I add that you have been lovely too.
Thank
Enjoyed
you.
Having you here.
Thank you so much.